You're listening to the Bragman Breakdown Podcast. Here's your host, Jackson Bragman.
Bragman Breakdown episode 97, welcome in. I'm your host, Jackson Bragman. Good one for the people today. It's been a while. It's been a few weeks. We took a little hiatus, got very busy, very caught up with schoolwork. But we're back, and we're back with a vengeance. We're back with Aaron Resnick. Aaron Resnick, NBA analyst, NBA expert, a guy that's been around the NBA for a long time, covered the NBA bubble in 2020. He has put together draft guides the past couple seasons that I've looked through that are just flawless and just phenomenal work that Aaron has put together. And I have been really impressed with the job that he's done. And he's received a lot of great feedback from members of various NBA front offices. So a guy that is, I think, just a really smart basketball mind that brought a lot of great insight to the Bragman Breakdown this week. So hope you guys enjoy episode 97. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Bragman Breakdown Pod. Follow us on TikTok at Bragman Breakdown. Pretty please rate the show 5 stars if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And without further ado, here is episode 97 of the Bragman Breakdown Podcast with Aaron Resnick. All right, Aaron Resnick is here. He's published acclaimed NBA draft guides over the last several years, and he's received some good feedback from NBA executives, from what I understand, and was in the bubble covering the NBA playoffs in 2020. Been around the league for a long time. All in all, just a well-seasoned basketball mind. So, Aaron, thanks for taking the time to come on the Bragman Breakdown today.
Oh, no problem, Jackson. Thank you for having me.
Of course. And, Aaron, we are talking NBA playoffs today. We have to start with undoubtedly the most entertaining series of the first round. Stephen Curry had 50 points in Game 7 to lift Golden State over Sacramento. And after having an 11-30 record on the road this season, the Warriors took care of business in Game 7 at the Golden 1 Center in front of a sold-out crowd of very passionate Kings fans, Aaron.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you told me that the Kings had won a game on the road, I would have probably told you with how the Warriors look traveling that the Kings are probably going to win this series. That one stung me. But like you said, Steph had a Game 7 for the ages. I believe that it's now the record for the most points scored in a 50-point game. But the Kings, for me, the thing was really interesting was just how much they struggled down low with Looney. Just had 3 or 4-game stretch where he just took over down low. The games where he was in there for Draymond, they had him facilitating offense. He had a lot of games with 16, 17 boards. And this game is like the final culmination where it seems like Sabonis is more focused than just trying to box him out instead of just going for the ball. I don't know, a lot of instances. There were like 3 or 4 instances that he had rebounds. So.
Yeah, what did you make of Sabonis' performance in the series? We'll get to Curry and we'll dive very deep in all of this, I'm sure. But I'm curious what you think about how Sabonis played.
Yeah, it is the interesting part to me with the Kings because it was such an encouraging year. But now it seems like they do have, now they sort of have to look and evaluate the roster for the next step. I mean, Herter, they didn't really get much from him this series. Barnes.
No, he was great in the regular season. He did not really show up, especially defensively on Curry. I thought he was just brutal in that Game 7. He was just looked like a middle schooler out there. He was not playing well.
Barnes had some shooting woes against them.
Yeah.
Sabonis seems like the first half, this last game, he was actually playing pretty well. They were daring him to take the mid-range shots. He was hitting them, knocking them down, and he seemed to be fully engaged. And then the second half, I'm not sure what happened, but it just seems that Looney just sort of took over physically. And then mentally, it seemed like he was in his own head on some of the shots. I know the free throws, I think there was one point he missed one, and then he drastically overcompensated, and I think it barely grazed the rim. But it's definitely going to be interesting because it's going to be, do they add another more physical player to complement him in the lineup? Like the Pelicans sort of have with Zion Williamson, would they have a Jonas Valanciunas next to him, or you look to move off? I don't think they'd look to move off him right away, but I'm going to be interested to see what they do with that offseason.
What are you looking for potentially in the draft for Sacramento? They're going to be late. I know you're an NBA draft guy, and I know you haven't dived quite as deep into the prospects this year as previous years, but positionally, what are you looking for kind of in the 20s or late teens for Sacramento to maybe pick up a guy that can make an impact for you next year?
I think for them, they'll have a few different spots that they could potentially address. I think they'd probably look for a potential developmental wing for either the eventual Harrison Barnes replacement. I think this might be the last year on his deal, or he'll be entering the last year of his deal, or like I mentioned, a potential backup big for Sabonis. I know that Derek Lively from Duke, that could be a guy that could be around there. I know he was gotten some buzz later in the year.
Lively got hot at the end of the season. He was number one prospect coming in. Rough start to the season, but tournament and an ACC tournament and last few ACC games there, he got hot, and he could be a really good defensive anchor at the next level. So that would be an interesting pickup for Sacramento if he falls to them.
Yeah, so I was going to say someone like that. I know he's a center that gained some traction last few months. So I think those could be some areas you could look for them to address. But the other concerning, questionable thing was, I think Davion Mitchell only played six or so minutes yesterday.
He was
the best on-ball defender.
That was the most head-scratching thing for me yesterday. I thought Mike Brown coached a great game. I thought that he did a good job managing. You know, Fox got into a little foul trouble at the end there, and he sat Fox with four fouls in the third quarter briefly, but then he brought him right back in with like 4 minutes left in the third quarter, which I thought was a very smart move, not leaving him on the bench for the rest of the quarter. I think that he had a great little pep talk and mic'd up moment at the beginning of the third quarter. Just the one really puzzling thing was why Davion Mitchell was not on the floor. I did not understand Trey Lyles getting minutes over Davion Mitchell. I did not understand Kevin Herter getting minutes over Davion Mitchell when Davion clearly had the best chance to slow down Steph. And he only played, like you said, single digit minutes. And it's not a good performance by the Kings defensively on Curry. I think Davion could have helped with that.
Yeah, for sure. It's like, I mean, there was a drought from a while where the Kings just weren't scoring at all, but it's like, well, if you're not scoring, at least you can limit their best player from scoring. And then I was even surprised, like someone like Alex Len or something didn't get a couple more minutes when they saw Sabonis like time and time again, just kept getting beat on the glass. Like, I think there's the one point where they got fouled, the Warriors got fouled, they took the free throws, they missed the free throws, then they kicked it out for a three. I think that was missed, and then it recovered for a jump ball, and then like three possessions later, I think they scored, and it was like, that's just be exhausting. And then you have someone like Stephen Curry who can make shots that can deflate an entire arena. It's just that they got the air sucked out of them there.
Warriors out-rebounded the Kings 22-9 in that third quarter, and that was really the separator. Warriors took a 10-point lead heading into the fourth, and you knew that a team that's been at this as long as the Warriors and that has as much experience in the playoffs as them, they were not going to relinquish a double-digit lead in the fourth quarter, and they put Sacramento away, running up the score late in this game seven. Let's talk about the Warriors' perspective of this. I think, first of all, we got to give Bob Myers credit for the way he's constructed this roster. He didn't have the finances and the cap space to sign both Gary Payton and Kevin Looney last offseason. So they brought back Looney. They knew how important he was to this team. And re-signing a guy like Kevin Looney is what makes Bob Myers such a great GM. And then when Gary Payton's stock was low and he was playing for the Trailblazers and he was injured, they made the move to trade for him at the trade deadline. And they get the best of both worlds. And Gary Payton came back. And when he played, I thought he was very good defensively in this game. He had one great block on Keegan Murray on the perimeter. And he was just really solid on the ball defensively. I think that this Warriors team with those role players, we know how special Curry is, and 50 points in a game seven, it's the most ever. I think when you look at the role players, whether you can consider Klay a role player or not, Klay has looked the best since his injury. He did not shoot it particularly well in this game seven, but he looks so smooth. He looks so much more athletic. He's actually putting the ball on the floor and driving to the rim now, as opposed to just catching and shooting. He's moving off the ball. And then defensively, he looks miles better than he did a year ago, so even a couple months ago. So I've been very impressed by Klay. I don't know what's got into him. You look at guys like Looney, Gary Payton, Draymond, obviously, with all his antics, is still a very valuable member of this team. And when Moses Moody gets minutes, I've liked him, even in this last Kings series, even in his limited play. I think that the Kings do have the roster, the Warriors do have the roster to maybe go back-to-back. What do you think about the long-term outlook? Do you think that the Warriors could win 12 more games and be the NBA champions this year?
I think it's definitely going to be an interesting matchup with the Lakers, because I think the Lakers do have a little more size, and I think ultimately their biggest X factor, win or lose, is going to be Jordan Poole. Because I know the way we saw him play this past series, he was so inconsistent offensively, defensively. It's been a struggle the last few years with him. He's getting just a consistent buy-in. Their lapses, a lot of young players have the lapses, but not all of them are, a lot of them don't have the championship pressure like he's obviously had the last couple years. But it's definitely going to be an interesting test in this series, because I do think right now the Lakers might have a little more bench punch for scoring. So I'm interested. So if Poole is, if they do keep him in the starting lineup, or if he comes off the bench, would be able to give him that dimension of what we've seen at times as a 20, 25 point per game guy who's very efficient. There, sometimes he and other players will be careless with turnovers. Dante DiVincenzo is another guy.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised he didn't work on some of these games this past series. And a lot of the Villanova guys under Jay Wright, they come and they know how to play complimentary basketball, know to make the right play, right read, which is always helpful when you're with a bunch of veteran guys. Stephen Curry. And we even had some stretches where we saw assertive Draymond, where a couple games where he was looking to create his own shot versus the Kings, which even if it isn't always going down, it's always important for the defense to not have to play, be defending, have five guys defending four the whole time. So I think interested to see more of that. I am on with the Lakers. I'm interested to see against them how I still feel like LeBron, even by his standard, by his very, very high standards, I do think the foot injury is a factor. So I am interested to see how they play with the Warriors' pace. I'm interested to see how that works. And if they do try and make it a three-point shooting contest, I don't think they will, but there might be games where it turns into that. So that's some, those are some of the main points I'm interested in.
Yeah, let's talk about the Lakers-Grizzlies, and then we can dive deeper into this upcoming matchup between LeBron and Steph. Lakers beat the Grizzlies in six games and looked really impressive doing it. First thing I want to ask you, Aaron, is how did the Lakers turn this thing around at the trade deadline? 18-9 finish in the regular season after the trade deadline, picked up Jared Vanderbilt, picked up Malik Beasley, and most importantly, picked up D'Angelo Russell, who's been phenomenal for this group. How did the Lakers turn this thing around in such a short amount of time? And who gets the most credit here for this Lakers group?
Yeah, that's interesting because I know, like, depending on social media, you'll see people go, oh, look at the Lakers since Russell Westbrook left. And then you'll see people say they've gotten so much better and it's all because he left. No, there's a lot of more moving pieces just that. I think, like you said, Jared Vanderbilt's been a huge pickup for him. He's not much of a shooter, but he is able to spend time defending guards, which at 6'9", 6'10", he's very long. He's got the wingspan to guard larger guys. That's, even if it's for just short spurts, he was able to go out and defend John on the perimeter, other guys on the perimeter, which is very helpful because it saves minutes off guys. Like you said, Russell's been a big addition for them. He can facilitate. He can score off the ball, create his own shot a little bit. But I do think them putting Austin Reeves in the lineup has helped them a lot because he's another guy. He knows how to play. He'll make the right pass, know where to be. He competes on the defensive end. He doesn't make many mental mistakes. So
he's great. I have a question for you, Aaron. Austin Reeves, is he right now, and I want you to think about this because I think the answer is yes. Is Austin Reeves the best white American basketball player right now? I mean, it's Slim Pickens, but he has been that good. I think you look at like maybe Tyler Hero. I don't know. I think he's been next level. He's been so underrated for this Lakers group. He does a little bit of everything, and he is the perfect complement to LeBron. He's been phenomenal. I think the answer is yes.
We actually are in, it's a mini golden age for the white guard between him. We have Caruso playing that could play all NBA level defense. And then Hero, he's our reigning, he won sixth man of the year last year. So it's actually not a bad little race.
It's only true.
But I do think of the three guys mentioned, Reeves is probably the most complete player. So
I agree.
What do you think? There's a strong case to be made for him.
No,
I hadn't thought about it, but. I think there is a chance.
I mean, just the difficulty of some of the shots driving inside. He gets no respect from the refs. I noticed this. He gets no calls, which is very upsetting to see because he's such a talented player, and he takes a beating inside. He gets no calls. For some of the fouls that are called in today's NBA, for him not to get foul calls underneath the basket is ridiculous. But the difficulty of the shots that he's making, the clutch plays, he's just playing at such a high level right now. I can't understate how important of a piece he is for them. When you look at this,
I was gonna say, I know with Reeves, they might be trying to overcompensate because I know there was a stretch, I believe, in late March, or I think it was late March, where he had like, he's averaging like 10, 11 free throws a game. So he was like getting, I think it was when LeBron was out, and he was getting a pretty good whistle. So I think they might be trying to overcompensate for it, because I remember that was like when the talk about him like was really going in the hyper drive.
National. Yeah, that's when he was getting all that hype. And I think now come postseason, they might be overcompensating, like you said. Looking at this Lakers-Warriors series, I'm leaning Lakers. I think it's going to be LA. When I just look at how important Looney was in that Kings matchup, and no disrespect to Sabonis, but Anthony Davis had 13.7 rebounds and 4.3 blocks a game against Memphis in round one. I think that's a major mismatch on both ends in favor of the Lakers. I'm very curious to see who's going to guard Steph. I have a feeling it's going to be Vanderbilt for the majority of the time. I think he did the best job on Ja in the last series. But I wouldn't be surprised if in the fourth quarter LeBron's up to the task and LeBron says, clear out, let me guard Steph. So I think that'll be an interesting factor, how the Lakers can limit Steph Curry's offense. I just think the Lakers have a more complete group. I think when you look at their two best players, they arguably have two of the best 10 players in the world right now. And the Warriors cannot say that. Even if Steph Curry might be top three, maybe number one player in the world right now, I think that the Lakers are a little bit more of a complete group, and they're hot at the right time. I think it's going to be LA.
Yeah, I know. It's like if people, I know there are jokes online and stuff at Anthony Davis's expense, but none of them are ever about the caliber of him as a player. It's like if everything's clicking, he's top 5-10 player in the world, as you mentioned. But like you said, unlike Sabonis, you don't have to worry about. It's like if you're going to give him those mid-range jumpers, he'll take them. He's not afraid to take them. He's a more physical down low in terms of physical down low. He's a better free throw shooter. I don't know if he's going to go out there and take 3-4 threes a game, but he can maybe hit one if you give him a couple attempts. So I think you're probably going to get at least 7-8 more points out of him than you got from Sabonis that series. I don't know what he averaged, 15, 16. Just estimated from watching. I don't have the numbers in front of me, I'm sorry. But so I think that's probably a mismatch, like you said. The Vanderbilt one, I'm interested to see how he would fare covering Curry, just because I think Curry presents such a difficult cover compared to the rest of the league with how much he runs off the ball. Like, I think someone like Ja Morant is obviously incredibly athletic, tough to stop when he's trying to get to the rim, but I feel that someone like Desmond Bane had the ball, or he was operating out of pick and roll. Ja is more just standing along the perimeter and isn't just constantly going off screens or pin downs compared to Morant. So it's going to be a difficult task for any player. So I wouldn't be surprised if they almost just have a committee and just trot out guys that are fresh, just rotate and try and see how everything goes, because it's tough. It's tiring a lot mentally and physically to cover him.
Let's talk Denver. The Nuggets finished this season first in the West, got by the Timberwolves relatively easily. Jokic had an MVP caliber season, and they won game one against Phoenix, but many are still hesitant to consider Denver the odds-on favorites in this thing. They looked really good on Saturday night. Today, it's Monday today. On Saturday night against the Suns. Jokic was getting anything he wanted offensively. And Murray, my God, Murray is so back. This is prime Jamal Murray. This is you witnessed Jamal Murray in the bubble live in person. And this is not quite the same, because since the ACL injury, he doesn't have quite the same explosiveness and he's not quite as quick twitched, but he's still scoring at the same rate because he's so much more skilled. I think he's kind of taken on a little bit more Chris Paul to his game. He's slowed down a little bit, but he's such a smarter player, and he's getting to his spots whenever he wants. And the way that that dynamic duo is playing right now, I think it's going to be very, very difficult for Phoenix to stop that. And Denver already has a 1-0 lead. So why do you think that that people are hesitant to pull the trigger with Denver, Aaron?
I think there, for some reason, there is some hesitance with Jokic. I think people have hesitance with him because in terms of what we have seen since he's been considered an elite player, in terms of the two-time MVP, we've seen the team shorthanded. So I know the first year before the bubble, I think they made it to the, I believe they made it to the second round, and Murray again, Rose had a good postseason, and you saw like signs that he could become like an all-star caliber player. Then they had the bubble. Jamal plays out of his mind. Jokic has some big games in there. It's like, he plays great, but he's sort of overshadowed. But then when Jamal goes down, I believe they lost in the second round, the Phoenix, when they eventually won the West. And then this past season, they lost, I think, in five to obviously the current defending champion Warriors. But, and this is the first time we've had a fully healthy team from them. Like, I know we have playoff Jimmy Butler, how he sort of takes his game to a different level, but when Murray's there, he basically becomes their primary option. It's like he's much more assertive, and their pick and roll with him and Jokic is hard to stop because, I mean, there are even some games, I think, where they're, I think in Minnesota, they were daring Jokic to shoot from three, and Jokic is a 40% three-point shooter. That's not, it's like if that's your best outcome, it's like that's very difficult offense to stop. I mean, you got Aaron Gordon. I know living in Orlando, there were times he tried to play like become like an all-star wing type player, but he's fully embraced his role here. He defends. He can defend your opponent's best player. He's a smart cutter. He can pass a little bit.
Really smart cutter. Yeah. No, he does a little bit of everything. He's had the best season of his career for sure. And he's been freakish. And yeah, in Orlando, we knew him as the dunk contest winner and this freakish athlete that was trying to do a little bit too much. He's really embraced his role. Like you said, I think that's a very astute point. And you mentioned the Jamal Nikola pick and roll. I mean, sometimes Jamal is the screener. Sometimes Jokic has the ball up to, and it's so fun to watch these guys. I just get a kick out of this group. I think Bruce Brown is like the defensively, they have so many guys that they can throw at you. I just think that these guys are the favorites to come out of the West. I think they're the most complete. And I think that duo of Jamal and Jokic is going to be fun to see go up against LeBron and AD in the conference finals, potentially, if we do get that. The Suns, though, we don't want to count them out, including the postseason. Phoenix is 12-2 with Kevin Durant this season. So they're playing very high-level basketball with KD, 8-0 in the regular season with KD, and then obviously the four wins against the Clippers, and then the one loss to the Clippers, and the one loss last Saturday. Aaron, how does Phoenix match up with Denver moving forward in this series?
I was thinking about it, and there are actually a few concerns I had about Phoenix in this series, but I think they're both fixable. Offensively, I think they're fixable. I know it seems crazy to say in 2023, but they might, I don't know if they take enough threes to win big in this era of basketball. I think they had a couple games against the Clippers where they only made 8 or 9 threes as a team, which seems really hard to believe when you see they have Devin Booker, Chris Paul, Kevin Durant.
In game one, Booker was 0-for-1 from three.
Yeah, it's like you'd think those guys, like even just to keep defenders honest, it's like there's a point they were shooting 60% as a team because the Nuggets were shooting 48% from three and they hit 8 of them, they're up like 13, 14 points. So eventually it's even like, I know Durant, Booker, Chris Paul, they're all incredible mid-range shooters, but just some of those attempts coming from deep would help stretch the defense. And I know there are a lot of possessions I noticed where they would go, Denver would happily live with the ISOs and the mid-range shots because it also would limit exposure of Jokic having to defend the rim. Now we know we love Jokic, but defending, he's not a like Jaren Jackson or Anthony Davis type rim protector. So I do think that's could be an interesting wrinkle if instead of settling for the jumper, if they try and be more assertive in attacking the rim, drawing fouls.
There were a couple times, and KD is not usually one to put his head down and get downhill. There were a couple times when KD took advantage of that Jokic matchup down low, and he got a couple and ones at the rim, a couple nice finishes, finger rolls. I thought that was working quite nicely for them. That could be the key to their success moving forward. I will say, you know, the mid-range stuff, I agree. I think that the volume of threes probably needs to be higher, but the way that Booker has been playing and the way that Booker contorts his body and the angles of some of these like 17, 18 footers that he hits, you can count on one hand the number of players in the league that can make those shots. I mean, it is just next level. He is playing his behind off so far in this postseason. And I would not be so quick to count out Phoenix yet. But an interesting stat for you from the broadcast on Saturday: the Suns starters this season accounted for 88% of the team's points, which is the third highest in the NBA in the last 40 years. So this team is not deep. Their top four is great with Paul, Booker, KD, and Ayton. And then who's the fifth starter is Torrey Craig. I believe in game one, it wasn't Torrey Craig. It was,
I think they tried a Kogi to,
yeah, it was a Kogi to try to mix things up. And yeah, like, I mean, Landry Shamet is not the player that he was a couple years ago. Even I just don't like the depth on this team. I think that, Denver is going to be too much for them in this series, but I won't count them out because of how well Devin Booker has been playing so far. And they have KD, who's one of the top five players in the league, arguably. So you can't count this group out yet, only down 1-0. But
you definitely can't.
My pick will be Denver.
I would lean Denver myself. I don't think I definitely don't think you can count them out, but I definitely think it'll be an interesting offseason for Phoenix because they'll now have a full offseason to get acclimated to having the Booker and Durant tandem. They'll get to fit. Construct the roster in a way to fit that. Right now, they don't really have like 3-and-D wing type players. I mean, they have some guys who could have played 3-and-D, but they obviously had to trade Kevin Durant. So,
yeah, you know who would be just perfect for this team right now? Mikal Bridges would just be
brilliant. Yeah, you get a Mikal Bridges or Cam Johnson out
there. Yeah, even Cam Johnson. I was going to say, even Cam Johnson would be phenomenal. Yeah, I think it's gonna be the Nuggets, but it will be interesting to see what Phoenix does this offseason. And KD only played 8 regular season games with the Suns this season, so a full offseason, like you said, to acclimate, to get to know his teammates, a full training camp, a full season to get acclimated. I think that will immensely help the Suns, and I think that they're gonna have a much better chance coming back next year than they did this year. Although KD with his injuries is going to be a year older. Chris Paul is going to be a year older. So they are working against the clock a little bit. Let's move on to the East, Aaron. The Cavs and the Knicks is a series I want to talk about first. This was kind of a surprising result for me. I thought Cleveland was the more talented team. I picked them in 7 games, but they ran into the buzzsaw that was Jalen Brunson.
Yeah, I honestly thought the Cavaliers were going to win the series I thought Darius Garland was going to be more effective. I thought his game was really going to translate to the postseason, but this might have been just a bad matchup for him and the Cavaliers. Going back, I saw that, granted, both teams' rosters were drastically different compared to when they played now, but the Knicks did have their number in the regular season. The Cavs, though, I think it really hurt them is the lack of scoring out on the wings in terms of guys like, they didn't get much production outside of two guards. Like, LeVert produced some games, but then guys like Okoro, who's a better defender, they're hesitant to start him at others. Chetty Osman, I'm not sure if that's a guy you want to count on for 25, 30 minutes in a playoff game, but rotational piece, he's fine. And then Evan Mobley still has room to grow. I think we might have got a little ahead of ourselves anointing him as like the next great big man, but he's still going to be very good, but he's still very young. He's still going to become more assertive, build muscle. But Jared Allen, disappointed. I thought he would have performed better, but Mitchell Robinson looked incredible that series.
Robinson was really good. He was the outside of Brunson. He was the one consistent piece for New York. And what's so ironic is that Knicks fans were foaming at the mouth this offseason to trade for Donovan Mitchell, but Cleveland got him. So New York had to settle for signing Brunson, who has been nothing short of a sensation for them. He has been their best point guard since Walt Frazier. I looked through the list. He has been their best point guard since Walt Frazier. And after this series, I think the question must be asked, who would you rather have on your team for the next 5 years, Jalen Brunson or Donovan Mitchell?
I think it would definitely depend on the roster, but I think Jalen Brunson is an easier fit into most rosters given the way he could play. Well, I know his contract descends, so that's also beneficial to slot in for pretty much anybody. But the way he plays, he can facilitate for others. Like, we've seen him play off the ball when he played with Luka. So the guy knows how to win. Came, like I said earlier about DiVincenzo, came from the Villanova program. They know how to do the little things. They know how to play. It's like, it's a guy. I'm actually surprised the market wasn't higher for him. I mean, there might have been so many teams that figured it was a sure thing with the Knicks that didn't bother, but it's like now looking back, it's like people thought it was a potential overpay. It's like now it looks like they got quite the steal. It's like he's scoring.
I was singing his praises all offseason, Aaron. Everyone said, yeah, people were saying this is an overpay. I could not fathom a universe where $110 million for 4 years for Jalen Brunson was an overpay. All the signs were there in Dallas. I am wrong so frequently about the NBA. It's unbelievable. Like for a guy that watches as much as I do, how wrong I am. Jalen Brunson, I knew this was going to happen. You could see it so clearly that in the minutes that Luka was not on the floor in Dallas, he completely took over. He was an essential piece of that roster. And you saw they missed the play-in this year without him. That's how important Jalen Brunson was to this Dallas roster. And he is doing great things for New York.
If I'm not mistaken, they had some games his last year in Dallas where Luka was out and he was the guy. And I think they were actually against Donovan Mitchell and he helped lead them to win. So it was like, this guy is like, if you had the question, oh, can he take over a playoff game? The answer was, yeah, he can do it. So I definitely think he's proven his fans like yourself. And I was actually a fan of Brunson's game, correct? So, and the doubter's wrong. So I think the Knicks fans are ecstatic. See if they get past the Heat and see if Julius Randle gets healthy.
Yeah, this will be a very interesting series. I think that I'm worried about the Knicks in the sense that outside of Mitchell Robinson and Jalen Brunson, this team has been very inconsistent. RJ Barrett started playing a lot better games 3 through 5, and then he had a nice game 1 against the Heat. But Randle got benched in the fourth quarters of games 4 and 5. I think he played only 16 minutes in game 5. That was a bit bizarre to me. He was just so ineffective. And on possessions where Jalen was not the primary ball handler, there were possessions where Brunson would bring the ball up the court and then he would give the ball to Randle or Barrett at the top of the shot clock, 17 seconds left. And then he would just go stand in the corner. Maybe he would make a cut off the ball and he would try to move around, but he didn't touch the ball again for the rest of the possession. And the offense just totally broke down at that point for New York. Randle could not get anything going on his own. Barrett could get to the rim at times, but RJ Barrett's not a guy that you're going to put the basketball in his hands and ask him to create offense for his teammates and create even a shot around the perimeter for himself. He can put the ball on the floor, put his head down and get downhill. Yes. But outside of that, not a particularly skilled offensive player. So I think that Jalen Brunson is so crucial to this team. And I think that, that without him involved in the offense, I think that, that's what you saw against Miami yesterday. That was when he was not involved, they capitalized. And I think that that Miami might actually have a very tough time. Or excuse me, New York might have a very tough time getting past Miami in this series.
The other thing with Randle being back is that would have to draw a lot of attention from Bam defensively. And given Randle's ability to handle the ball, play on the perimeter, and the muscle he has, it's like there is only one real guy in Miami that could really match up with that. I mean, Jimmy Butler certainly won't back down from it. He'll probably be out there and trying, but Bam is probably your best fit there, but they'd be giving so much size if Bam isn't on Mitchell Robinson.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how they'd counter it because right now the only guy, they don't really trust a lot of guys in that rotation outside of Kevin Love that are over 6'7", 6'8".
And Kevin Love is not a, a superstar defender at this juncture in his career. As fun as some of the outlet passes were yesterday, and as great as he's shooting the ball, and that looks like such a steal on the buyout market by Miami. I can't believe that Cleveland let him go at this rate.
Yeah, I was gonna say, given the lack of shooting that Cleveland had from their forwards and bigs in that series against the Knicks, it seems surprising that they let him go, but worked out well for the Heat because Love had some big games down the stretch for them in terms of shooting from three, giving them enough minutes defensively to at least tread water. So I definitely could see him re-signing with the Heat. I feel like that's a team a lot of guys like once they get in the culture and see what everything's all about, you get the good weather. I feel like a lot of guys enjoy staying there.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Heat part of this. Incredible to beat team with the best record in the NBA as a play-in team. This was Jimmy Butler's series, specifically the last two games where he scored a combined 98 points. He pulls out the game one win against the Knicks at MSG as well. And Aaron, this Miami team that we thought was dead to rights after that first play-in game against Atlanta is now three games away from the Eastern Conference Finals.
Yeah, I don't think even the Heat's biggest fans would have thought this is possible. I know I have a lot. I went to college down in South Florida. I have a lot of friends in that area. I know they were telling me there were fans that were talking about, well, if we were to go in the lottery, what type of odds would we have at this Wembanyama kid? But it's like now it's like you said, they're three wins away from the conference finals, and who knows what could happen at this point. But it's like, and we've seen Spoelstra is one of the better coaches, premier coaches in the league. Butler, it's like he's just got that gear that only some of the rarest guys have, where it's like they just can take it to another level and they'll take every ounce of their body, put it all into the game, just take over, do whatever's needed from them. But the interesting thing is, like, I still don't know how Milwaukee let them lost that way. It's like they let Butler, it's like the one thing, they let the one guy in particular beat them. They somehow had, I think the Heat were like dead last in shooting in the league entering the series. They caught fire. It's, like, it's just so. It's
I thought because they won that game one. And in that game one, they shot 60% from behind.
Yeah.
And it's like, I thought, okay, this must fizzle out. There's no way that they're going to sustain this. And then
they lost
two,
Tyler Hero.
And they lost Tyler Hero. Milwaukee crushed him in game two, and I'm like, okay,
no, Oladipo.
All
so
balance
like, okay,
has been restored. Yeah. And they just came out with a vengeance. They just could not miss. Kevin Love was on fire. And Jimmy was knocking down threes, which he normally doesn't do. He was scoring from all three levels. He was just, I mean, he was wonderful in the series. And game five, he was doing it on both ends too, which was so amazing. In game five, he had the craziest block. Portis swung it to Grayson Allen at the top of the key. And Jimmy didn't like tip this three-pointer. He full-on swatted it in midair, grabbed the loose ball, and beat Allen for a dunk on the other end of the court. And Ryan Russillo made a great point as well about how he was giving everything on both ends, and he was just gassed. But even with that being the case, he was still doing the little things of cutting off the ball to keep the offense circulating despite his fatigue. He's just on a different level right now. He's doing so much that shows up in the stat sheet, 56 points in game four, and he's doing so much that doesn't show up in the stat sheet. He is playing the best basketball of his career right now.
Yeah, that's a high bar to say considering everything he did last playoffs and then in the run they go to the finals for the Lakers. It's like there are a lot of great playoff games in there. I think I saw a stat that said that basically, like, in terms of like efficiency and I think it's a metric called game score on Basketball Reference. I think he has 8 of the 10 best playoff games in Miami history based on that metric, which considering they've had Dwayne Wade and LeBron, and it's a pretty young franchise, that's pretty hard to believe. But he's got that just in the last three seasons. Definitely has been fantastic for them. I'm interested to see if guys like Duncan Robinson against some more athletic players out on the perimeter are able to get the minutes that they got in the series against Milwaukee. Milwaukee is an older team without the athleticism a lot of teams have on the wing. So I'm interested to see what happens there. But, and then the size factor, the Knicks do have more size between Hartenstein, Mitchell Robinson, even guys like Randall.
But. Yeah. I forgot to mention, mention Hartenstein, who was actually playing very well. He played really well in that series.
Yeah, I know there are some other teams that had some interest in him this free agent season. I think even here in Orlando, there's some interest in him. But he's a great signing for the Knicks. He gives them a lot of energy off the bench. I know in the Clippers, I think he shot near 40% from three. He hasn't really brought that out with the Knicks in the games I've watched, but that's a weapon that could potentially be used if need be. But I'm definitely interested to see what the Heat do, because you can't count out Coach Spo, and we certainly know not to count out Jimmy Butler for now. I'm still not sure why the Knicks didn't attack Jimmy Butler in the final 6 minutes knowing he was hurt on defense, but only Thibodeau knows that right now. But I'm interested to see how healthy Butler looks throughout the series, because I'm assuming he's going to play. So it's really a matter of health for him, I'd imagine.
Taking a step back and looking at the Milwaukee standpoint of this, if you're Bucks GM John Horst, what does this offseason look like for you? And I guess the big looming question over the Bucks is there's only so much roster turnover you can do. You're not going to have a lottery draft pick. You've got all these guys. I mean, you're not going to blow this team up. You've got a great big three with Middleton, Holiday, and Antetokounmpo that was not fully healthy this season. So I think you largely are going to run it back with the guys you have. You're going to try to re-sign Brook Lopez. Is Bud gone? Is that the big move that Milwaukee's going to make this offseason?
I'm not sure what their move is going to be with Coach Bud. I know that seems like it would make sense, just because I know a lot of times someone has to take the blame for it, and it's the easiest to throw it on the coach. But I mean, I usually don't like throw on the coach, but there are some baffling errors the last few games in that series where Milwaukee just shouldn't have blown those leads. Like even that alley-oop that's going to, I'm sure, be played over and over with Jimmy Butler at the buzzer in the game five. It's like, you didn't have Brook Lopez out there to defend it, the rim in that instance. You had Pat Connaughton out there. It's like, why did you do that? You had a second left. You could have called timeout, gotten the ball your own end, and thrown something up. Why didn't you do that? You had 10 seconds left to get a shot up in the last game with two timeouts. You didn't take one. It's like, why was that? But I do think the Bucks are an interesting situation because, like you said, you have Giannis under contract. You have Jrue Holiday. You had to trade a lot of picks to get him. They won a title already, so it's already worth it. And with Jrue Bell's on both ends, he's worth that. Middleton's an interesting one because I believe he has a team option he could opt into for next year. But then I think I think he might be super max eligible, which might be, that might be $45, $50 million a year territory. So I know there have been some articles out saying that teams such as Dallas and I believe Houston might be interested in him. So if the Bucks might be able to get picks and get younger, have some younger building block pieces that they could add to this mix, I think it would be beneficial. But granted, they would have to take on some salary if they're going to trade Middleton or those guys go.
It'll be interesting to see Milwaukee's offseason. Let's move on to Sixers and Boston. Let's first talk about the 76ers and the Nets, because that was the first round series that we saw. Not a surprising result. The Nets really only made the playoffs this season because of their record with Kyrie and Kevin Durant. They finished the regular season 13-15 after the trade deadline. So yes, it was fun watching Mikal Bridges in the final month or so of the regular season. And I think because he was so good, people talked themselves into this Nets team, but they did not stand a chance against Philly. Aaron, what did you think of the Sixers in this series, and how do you think they'll fare against Boston?
I'm interested to see how they fare against Boston, because I think their biggest factor is obviously Joel Embiid in this series, because Boston's defense was, I know we focus on how good the scoring punch of Tatum and Jaylen Brown for Boston, but I feel like their defense was so good last season with the combination of Robert Williams. He was obviously fully healthy last year, which hasn't been the case. Marcus Smart was your defensive player of the year. Al Horford has been unsung defender who's finally getting more notoriety now, but they were fantastic last year. This year, it just seems like they haven't been defending at the same level. It's like the Hawks were, so they were outside of game one that series, the Hawks were pretty much routinely scoring 110, 115 points, which for a playoff game is pretty high. So I'm interested to see how they defend, but the Sixers without Embiid, it becomes a whole different thing. Is James Harden going to, does he have the gas to be the James Harden we saw in Houston? Is he going to resort to that? I know before we took our, before we started talking, I watched some of the game and Harden was actually taking a lot more mid-range jumpers than usual. He was having some success with that. Maxey will have to take on a bigger role. I think he's able to handle 15, 20 shots a game. And I think his speed will create a lot of trouble for teams of pressure on the rim. Tobias Harris will have to come up with a bigger role. I know he has shown he can be an efficient scorer in the right role, but
he had a good closeout game. Game four, he looked good. Yeah. I just think I'm kind of with you. I wasn't particularly impressed with Philly in this series. The Nets sent doubles and Embiid every chance they got, and he just couldn't adapt. He just was frazzled by it every time, whether he got the ball in the post or he got the ball 30 feet from the basket. It didn't matter. They brought the double every time. And what then needed to happen when Embiid drew the double and he couldn't really manage that was that Harden needed to step up, and he did not step up in this series. Aaron, do you know how many different times, I have an interesting stat for you. Do you know how many different times James Harden has led the NBA on free throws attempted?
Probably for the season, probably 8 or 9, I'd guess.
Seven times James Harden has led the NBA in free throws attempted.
He had some games where I don't think he got any. He had some games where he didn't get a call.
So Harden, who over his career has averaged 8.6 free throw attempts per game, has led the league seven different times, had attempted in his first three games of this series, three total free throws. He had no free throws in games one and two. He had three free throws in game three. It was only in game four when Embiid was out and Harden took 18 shots that he had eight total free throws attempted. So he shot 11 free throws in this series. He's not getting to the line the way he used to because the refs are no longer going for his flopping and his driving into guys and falling over. So there goes that. He's still a decent ISO scorer at times. He's still a very good passer at times, although I don't know if I even trust him to get you an ISO bucket at this point in his career. He shot 34% from the field in this series. He's really ineffective off the ball. He clogs things up for them. I just didn't see enough from Harden against Brooklyn to make me believe that they're going to take out Boston. I'm a lot more worried, funny enough, about Harden than I am Maxey. I love Tyrese Maxey. I cannot say enough positive things about him. I think that Maxey's going to fare quite well in this series against Boston. I am very worried about Harden, who historically has not been a great playoff performer, and he did not get off to a great start here against Brooklyn.
I think the one thing that could help Harden this series is he did the Nets series feels so long ago because we've seen so much basketball since then. They've had, I think, a little over a week off. And I do think the rest will really help Harden because I know with the Rockets, I think he had such a burden carrying the offense, playing 37, 38 minutes a game. I just think by the time the postseason ran around, he was gassed. So I think now he'll be a little fresher. I think he'll add a little more scoring punch than he added. Granted, the first series was a much lower bar than his career norms, but I do think he's going to end up stepping up a bit in this series. Now, it will be enough to offset Embiid potentially being out 2 to 3 games. We're yet to see, but I do think he'll have a better series than some think. I mean, Boston just has so much firepower. They have like 5 or 6 guys that could catch fire from deep and take your whole team out of its game.
Yeah, like, I mean, Brogdon had a great series against Atlanta. White had a great series against Atlanta. They just have dudes, man. And I for me, the X factor for Boston and the X factor in this series overall is Robert Williams. Because when healthy, he is one of, if not the best, defensive anchors in the whole NBA, when healthy. And we all like Nick Claxton. We all like Nick Claxton, but he's not slowing down Joel Embiid one-on-one.
Yeah.
Robert Williams is one of the few guys in the NBA right now that might be able to slow down Embiid. If Williams can contain Embiid, that puts so much more pressure on the Philly backcourt to perform. And I am not sure what we're going to see from Harden in the series. Tyrese was great in round one. Tyrese shot 43% from three against the Nets. Harden shot 34% from the field. I'm a lot more worried about Harden. I'm going to be very interested to see how this Philly backcourt performs, especially in game one tonight with Embiid out. And then the Celtics-Hawks series. I think we both agreed that the Celtics are probably going to take this second round series, but they look good against Atlanta. Trae Young played a couple really nice games, and there were a couple of outliers in there. Game three, Boston did not look good. But other than that, they played pretty well, even in game five, they didn't look too shabby. And then in the closeout game six, I want to talk about that a little bit. And that game in the fourth quarter just reminded me of how good Jason Tatum was. I mean, following his three and for a putback dunk at one point, nailing several threes from outside and just getting it done from all three levels, he looked amazing. Atlanta was actually up 113 to 120, and they just fell apart down the stretch and ended up losing by eight. Trey did not have it going in the second half, 1 of 12 from the field after scoring 25 in the first half. Hawks just couldn't get anything going offensively, and Boston capitalized on that. Boston's ball movement was really good, I thought. Tatum actually turned himself into a sneaky nice playmaker this season. And in the fourth quarter, Tatum thread the needle to Smart off the bounce pass on the slip. Really like Chris Paul-esque play with DeAndre Hunter on his hip, and Smart caught the ball low, brought it high over his head, drew help from the weak side, and then fired a beautiful pass over his head to Horford for the corner three. That was just a play that stood out to me, where the ball movement and the selfless play from the Celtics was really encouraging to see, and it made me really optimistic about Boston's potential offensive output against Philly in the next round.
I knew there's one play I was watching. It was against one of the games in the Hawks series, where it's like, I think it was one of the, for initial home games, there was a point where I think it was like a Tatum, there was like a high ball screen, and then you'd Williams just like slip right, and you Capella basically was stuck in no man's land, because he'd either have Robert Williams came out of his cut to slip the rim so quickly, he's like, yeah, all right, do I either concede an open dunk, or do I have to run all the way out to the corner and defend the guy who's about to get the ball for a wide open three? He's like, there's no way most of the bigs in the league are going to cover this. So they got four or five guys that can – you got three or four guys that can pass out of that on that team. You got six or seven guys that can hit that shot. It's like, that's really tough to guard, especially in a seven-game series, because it could just be rotating guys that fill those roles.
Absolutely. Aaron, your finals prediction and who's winning it all this year?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, with the injuries we've had, all the parity this season, this could age like – it might be insulting to spoiled milk if I said it would age like spoiled milk. I'm trying to think who else is. It'll probably sound cliche, but I'd probably go Lakers Celtics because I at least have a foundation of trust with some of the players and on the rosters and at least come through. But I do think for all time's sake, I'll go with the bubble conference finals of the Nuggets versus Lakers and the Celtics versus Heat, and just for all time's sake. And then probably pick Lakers and Celtics for those.
Who's winning that final series?
Oh, that's going to be a tough one. My first thought would be the Celtics, just because the roster is deeper. I mean, I think they have the best roster in the league right now, and I'm not sure if it's close. That's assuming health permitting. I mean, hopefully, I never want to see guys get hurt, especially if it could swing the title. So, as we know, anything could happen. I think a lot of teams left can make a run. Like you said, Phoenix can't count them. I can't count Denver out. I don't think you can count Philly out if Embiid ends up being healthy and coming back. So, I mean, the Miami, it's like Jimmy Butler's healthy and willing to take him. It's like, we've seen this before. Definitely be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning of Boston for sure out of the East. But it could be. I don't think it's going to be the winner of that New York-Miami series, but you never know. And then in the West, it's going to be the Lakers or the Nuggets, whoever wins that conference final series. I'm going to go with with Los Angeles there, but that's I could see that going either way.
I feel like
I could see the Warriors Lakers series going either way.
I was gonna say, I feel like you could talk yourself into almost any of the four teams that are left in the West to win it all. I think Phoenix for me might be the toughest sell because, like we talked on, the lack of overall roster depth. But I think you can definitely talk yourselves into any of them. It's like you can't ask for anything else. It's like the teams out West, you got each team has a former MVP. You got other players like Booker and Murray that are going to be rising the next generation of guys. It's like, what's not to like if you're a basketball fan right now? Yeah.
It's a great time for the league. Aaron Resnick, thank you very much for taking the time coming on the Breakdown today. Really appreciate it. You're welcome back anytime. We'll have you on for draft season once you familiarize yourself more with this year's prospects, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
All right, sounds great, Jackson. Thanks for having me.
Say I want fame so bad, it's all I can think about. Yeah, that I'm on a billboard and I'm making my mama proud. Yeah, hosting a meet and greet and I'm signing my signature. Yeah, random people they stopping me, can I get in a pic with ya? Oh, hey, oh. I look in the crowd, yeah. And I got fans now, goddamn I got fans now. Oh, hey, oh. They singing out loud now. They singing my words out, they singing my words. Say I just want the fame, yeah, so bad. Thinking about the things that I never had. Yeah, say I know that my star